Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rates and Lanes with your hosts, Rico Muhammad and Chuck Snow.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Rates and Lanes podcast. I'm your host, Rico Muhammad, and we will be joined shortly by my co-host, Mr. Chuck Snow, and of course, we have two special guests. We're going to have round two of the slobber knocker that we had a few weeks back with Mr. We're fortunate enough, so nice to get Hank Seaton back twice, and Tommy Roop will be joining us as well, and it's always a hoot when you get those two together. So we're looking forward to getting started with them, but before we do, let's jump into this week's trend lines report. We have no change in the average diesel price of fuel nationwide. Nationwide, the national average price for diesel fuel is sitting at $2.44 per gallon on average. National averages for truckload rates on the spot market keep climbing to new heights. Though load-to-truck ratios decline, activity slowed and many businesses taking time off for Labor Day. And also the 24-hour, well, it wasn't 24 hours, but the little CSVA blitz, of course, that always adds a little bit more, takes a little capacity off of the road for the people trying to avoid the ramifications of getting caught up with a inspection or whatever. So without any further ado, let's jump over and see how the rates were performing for these respective modes of transportation, starting out with dry vans coming out of the northeastern portion of the United States. If I can get my technology catches up with me with loading. There we go. Coming out of the northeast, we're showing average spot market rates at 192. Coming out of the mid-Atlantic and southeastern region of the United States, we're showing average spot market rates at 217. Coming out of the Midwest, we're showing average spot market rates for dry vans at 245. Coming out of the south central region of the United States, we're showing an average rate of 225. And coming out of the West Coast for dry vans, we're showing an average rate of $2.50 per mile. Jumping over, switching gears to the flatbed portion of the report, starting out in the northeastern portion of the United States. Just waiting on my technology to catch up with me. So coming out of the northeast, we're showing an average spot market rate of 207. Coming out of the mid-Atlantic and southeastern states, we're showing average spot market rates for flatbeds at 250. Coming out of the Midwest, we're showing average spot market rates for flatbeds at 251. Coming out of the south central region of the United States, we're showing average spot market rates for flatbeds at 232. And coming out of the West Coast, wrapping up, showing average spot market rates at $2.15 per mile. And with that being said, we're going to jump over into the temperature-controlled or reefer portion of the trend lines report. Coming out of the northeast, we're going to show spot market rates at $2.12 per mile on average. Coming out of the mid-Atlantic and southeastern states, we're showing an average of $2.17 per mile. Coming out of the Midwest, very strong, $2.81 per mile on average. And coming out of the south central region of the United States, we're showing an average of $2.35 per mile. And coming out of the West Coast, wrapping up the report, an average spot market rate of $2.67 per mile. With that being said, let me go ahead and welcome my co-host, Mr. Chuck Snow. Chuck, good evening. How are you?
We're doing well. How are you, Rico?
I cannot complain, not one bit. We are trying to stay busy and get some things accomplished. How about you guys up there north of the border?
Well, you know what? Things are quite busy, actually. There seems to be no shortage of freight these days. So I'm glad to see we are all in the right business.
Right. And with that being said, like I was alluding to earlier in the introduction, we got two special guests this evening that, you know, they kind of spoiled us the first go round. It was so nice we had to have them back twice. So going to go ahead and welcome Hank Seaton, our transportation expert, legal expert, and our insurance expert, Mr. Tommy Root, back to the Rates and Lanes podcast. Gentlemen, good evening. How are you doing?
Good evening.
Good evening. Hank, I'm glad to be with you, my friend. It's always an honor to be with the boss.
Well, we must have been more entertaining than I thought we were. We got invited back.
So I'm gonna say this early, and I'm gonna say it often, because I want for our people that are listening in, if you want the opportunity to ask a question, don't be afraid, don't be bashful. Press number one. We'll get you involved in the conversation. You know, it's not,
come on, Rico,
not every day.
Nobody's gonna get a word in edgewise with these two.
Well, it's not every day you have an opportunity to pick the brain of two seasoned veterans like this. So, you might as well try your best to take advantage of it while the opportunity presents itself.
Well, I want to say, you just got called old. No, you got called a seasoned veteran. I want to start this show with a question I have to both of you that I don't understand. And tell me how this is done. I was reading tonight in Freight Waves earlier on about a startup that is, and their idea, some guys that had worked for Uber, and they started their own business to put drivers in trucks. And it sounds like it's going to be somewhat of an Uber-type thing, except it's going to be random drivers going into trucks that belong to fleets where they're short of drivers. And I have a question for both of you. My understanding, how we've been running our business for the last 20-odd years anyways, is before we can put a driver in a truck, we have to follow a certain criteria. There's a road test, there's a drug test, there's a background check, all these things, and they have to be road tested by us. How do these, and this is really a pseudo personnel agency that I think is going to pay these drivers as companies, if I read between the lines, how does this work for somebody that's domiciled in the U.S. to use a service like this when they haven't had a chance to do the due diligence on that individual? Does going through a driver service negate having to do all this?
Yeah, let me take that one. This is nothing new. This is the old rent-a-driver deal. It's right. been around for years. These people function as one of two things. First of all, they claim they're the statutory employer of the driver, and they're providing to the motor carrier occasional labor to run the extra board. They do the qualification obligations of the FMCSA and provide the qualification docs to the motor carrier, so that the motor carrier can dot his I's and cross his T's. Some of the issues and problems with the model is it doesn't work. For years, there have been these third-party vendors who said they were the statutory employer, and the unions have walked right through that as a shell against unionization under the co-employment theory. So if you're hiring some guy to be the statutory employer of the driver, you're not getting a protection against unionization. After AB 5, it's pretty well recognized that if you don't bring, it's been traditionally recognized, if you're just hiring a driver, he's going to ultimately be your employee for employment law. And the idea that you're just going to somehow escape compliance is another issue. I think they're going to have a hard way to hold most of the people that do these third-party driver services. When you read the contract, it doesn't say that they're going to defend you against the misclassification suit or that the driver is not going to be found to be your employee. And ultimately, if you're dispatching him, you're controlling him. So, you know, more power to anybody that wants to try it. I think it's halfway damaged. Tommy can certainly comment on the insurance aspects. What I have seen is on the workman's comp side, sometimes these intermediaries claim they can get lower workman's comp rates, but I have a real problem with how an insurance company that's writing BI and PD would consider underwriting someone who had an occasional labor force they couldn't check out.
Okay, let me take that, okay? And Chuck, I haven't read the article, so I don't know this is how it's structured. But every state recognizes the employee leasing concept. This is co-employment right. In every state. And in those states, as Hank just said out, you have two employers. You have the statutory employer, which is an employee leasing company, who's responsible right. For the pay, work comp, SUTA, FUTA, and all that. Then you have the common law employer, and that is the motor carrier. And I actually owned a portion employee leasing company for 10 years, dealing in agriculture, and wrote some truckers. As a statutory employer, I can do all the screening of the driver and then provide them to the motor carrier and meet all those requirements. Unlike one other part, and then the states have either passed laws or the court cases that says the statutory employer can provide work comp and tort immunity is given for suit is given to the common law employer in the co-employment level and in Florida and other states in the state statute. So the worker cannot sue, the driver cannot sue the motor carrier lease suit under tort, and they would extend to the tort immunity would be extended to them. And also every liability policy written, auto liability and or general liability excludes injuries to employees, which include lease workers. So the auto liability and general liability is not a problem. The problem you're going to have with it, though, because it's not all blessing, is that now this doesn't cover any other. The work comp is provided by the employee leasing company does not cover any other worker that motor carrier has. And it won't cover this right. lease worker until that lease worker is assigned to that employee leasing company. In other words, the motor carrier does the screening and then assigns that worker to the employee leasing company, which doesn't pick up the owner-operators, it doesn't pick up the office staff and things like that. That's the downside. But it does work. Now, it's economic factors because Hank just said you're going to have to pass the cost over to the motor carrier. And could the motor carrier buy this work comp coverage and sometimes benefits, employee practice liability, health insurance can be provided by all these employee leasing companies. So the question is, does it work economically? The downside to it is that if they don't pay, then the contract can be terminated immediately, which in some cases will even have the driver out on the highway.
Okay. Now, where does it stand? Like, I know that if I did something like this with my insurance company, they'd be all over it because our people didn't road test him, for example. He's not on our roster as a driver. You know, there's a bunch of things. He's not on our roster under drug testing. How does that work? I'm just really curious.
Chuck,
how this works
as
in this day and
age. Company, first the motor carrier would do the test driving. And in all the situations. So they would do the test driving. Either the employee leasing company, because of being the co-employer, would have the rights to an obligation to do the drug testing and with the drug clearinghouse and would arrange for the drug testing. It would have to be worked out contractually who would handle the drug testing at the crash site, but they would be in the random pool. We actually had the drug test and had a drug-free workplace. and we provide the drug testing for all the workers that are assigned. See, this, and this might be a little different. This might be a tip service, which has a different kind of statute that allows that. But the employee leasing, the PEO concept, the employee leasing concept is one that has a lot of traction in trucking. Now, this new right. one where you have a recruiter involved in it, this sounds more like a temp service. And that doesn't yeah. have everything I talked about. And that would be more of a concern you'd have for liability and other things from a temp service.
That's
yeah,
what it is.
Tommy,
really.
Tommy's
so
making an important distinction between the renter driver, which is the third party employer goes out and
right.
recruits the guy to bring in to run an extra board, and what is the preferred method now, which is you go out and you recruit the driver, but you hire him through this third party.
Right.
The benefit that I've traditionally seen is particularly in states that have high workman's comp exposure. Sometimes these, call them the rent-a-driver types, will be able to get access to workman's comp at lower rates by getting different mods or playing with that. And sometimes that is that's their sales tool to a company. Also, when there is an accident, and Tommy can probably say amen to this, the rental drivers don't get sued along with everybody else for negligent hiring. I've been in accident litigation where some poor sucker who was sitting here with a workman's comp program all of a sudden found himself defending an accident as a named defendant. So it's one more person for plaintiff's bar to name in a lawsuit.
Okay.
The thing I find about this is that I don't know who that would appeal to, because aren't you in a position to hire your drivers in a more favorable position than this rental driver? I don't know how they can throw a cash over a larger area to screen them to make it worthwhile.
Well, that's what I think. But the only thing I can think that would be the advantage to the individual truck driver looking for work is he may be able to be paid as a company. And I cannot and I will not pay anybody driving one of my trucks as a company. They're on payroll. I'm not going down that road where you pay these guys by companies, where they set up their own corporation. And I think that is the I think that is their loophole or whatever you want to call it, and their advantage to recruiting is these guys think that they're they own a little company and they're going to try to get these write-offs that a corporation would. I know in Canada they closed off every one of those loopholes. We had quite a stink up here called Driver Inc. And the feds,
if the guy doesn't bring his own equipment, in most states it's a personal service contract, and that
right.
dog don't hunt. What I'm seeing a
exactly.
lot of in terms of these third parties is in the less than 10,000 pound GVW. Everybody is out trying to recruit neophytes to make home deliveries, and there is no driver qualification files, and a lot of the other things fall by the wayside. So there are a lot of guys jumping into that. Think, well, gee, I'm going to make the van available and I'm trying to hire a driver, but I don't want to put him on workman's comp and all this other stuff. So they turn to these third-party hiring companies thinking that they're going to expose some employment liability. I think it's a flawed idea. I've had to look at some of these contracts over the years. And there's no indemnification that they'll stand up and take the hit for the motor carrier in the event of an assessment or a misclassification suit or anything else.
Yeah,
I don't want to get too deep in it
because
we got other things. Chuck, we got too many things that we want to talk about. But there won't be
okay.
any misclassification because they're going to be an employee of somebody. and they'll be paid, and they'll get paid wages and pay work comp and pay unemployment. I don't think that, other than the union thing, which I hadn't thought about that Hank brought up, that's not going to be a problem, but it's just, Hank said one thing that's important. Any of these agreements, you've got to look at the contract. It boils down to the wording in the contract, period.
Right. And, you know, everything's fine until there's a claim, until somebody falls on ice or wrecks, you know, smashes up the truck and becomes a paraplegic and then just follow the money. Somebody's going to have to pay.
Well, there'll be work comp in place in both of those arrangements.
There should be. The question becomes, and there is cut-through liability on workers' comp if this intermediary doesn't have it. Co-employer status may apply. Before we go on to something else, I'll tell you all a story. I was a young lawyer, and that's been way back in last century, and I attended a Sixth Circuit argument in which the Teamsters were trying to bust through to the motor carrier through a rent-a-truck alternative. And I saw a grown man cry when the defense lawyer was told by the judge, your arguments are outrageous, you're a co-employer, and these guys can unionize the company in Cincinnati. And that's kind of stuck in my mind, and, you know, that's a decision from now over 45 years ago when this whole idea of a statutory employer was thought to be a protection against unionization.
Right.
Yeah, Hank and I agree on that. I don't get involved in that. I was talking about the co-employment.
Yeah, you guys don't agree on that.
Anyway, what else we going to talk about?
We'll take it. I got a question, kind of a personal, and then but someone else sent me this question as well. When it comes to dealing with insurance, the person they had in my situation. Had a small little fender bender, was going to get the truck fixed. But then, after discovering some other stuff that was wrong with the truck mechanically, decided to just go ahead and sell the truck. Now, there was a claim in for physical damage. Does the insurance company still pay the responsible for the physical damage, even though the repair was not done? There was no lien hold or nothing like that involved.
The answer to that question is yes. There's no requirement to repair it that way. You get paid for whatever damage it is, or whatever damage was caused, Rocco. There's no relief because you did not actually repair it. There's a little more negotiation, a little more fear here, because you don't know about internal damages and this kind of stuff, so you'll end up just getting a agreement on how much damage is done, and they should stroke you a check.
Let me ask you a question here.
Hold on a second. If Rico does that and he gets that money from the insurance for the fender bender to fix the truck, does that not make his insurance go up?
Yeah, he will have the insurance history of having a physical damage claim. Yeah.
So is he not better off to not take the money and not put the claim through, and will he not? In the end, that's not going to be on his record. How does that work?
Well, Chuck, he'll have to balance that. Physical damage doesn't go up that high. It's not like liability. There's not that much of one-on-one correlation for physical damage as you would for liability.
Okay. Because it's a set amount. They're not worried about a bunch of lawyers on the other side.
Yeah, you're not worried about lawyers on the other side, and they settle it. And depending on the circumstances, and go back to the driver and their past history, if they have too many of them, then, you know, they'll get all nervous and have some concern. But a physical damage loss is not one that most people, unless it's repeated, a lot of them, that most insurance companies do not worry about.
Okay.
The only caveat I'd get is be sure that the insurance company agrees to the extent of the damage, because if you sell the truck,
right,
then they say, well, we could have got it fixed cheaper, then you've got a problem.
Well, yeah, that well, you don't fix that, it, you just get a check. And the problem is if there's some hidden damage when they sell it, unless they can sell it as is, there could always be some hidden damage the insurance company is not going to pay for now after it was sold. That's the danger. And large and big crashes, that is a problem because you don't know how much damage is internal damage is done.
Right. Okay. Well, that answers my question. Hopefully the other person was listening in that had the same question.
So, this is scary. Hank and I are agreeing almost 4-on-4 here. I don't know.
This isn't going good.
I didn't think we disagreed with that much last time, and they sound like this was a battle of titans or something.
That's exactly what I said. It's going to be the battle of the titans.
Just because I beat up on insurance companies doesn't mean I'm beating up on Tommy.
I can't help if you can't read policy.
Let me put it back out for all the listeners that are listening in. Tonight we have Tommy Rook and Hank Seaton is joining us again. Tommy is our resident insurance expert. Hank is our resident legal expert. So if anyone has a question pertaining to whether it's insurance and legalities, press number one. You can get involved in the conversation. You can ask a question. You can get involved in the discussion. There's no such thing as a stupid or a dumb question. I see we got quite a few people on the line that are listening in live with us tonight. We always welcome your interaction. Never feel intimidated that you can't get on here and talk with us. Everybody puts their pants on the same way.
Before we burn up all our time, Tommy, I understood that one of the things you wanted to talk about that I've really got an interest in is the new FMCSA idea that they'll use a desktop audit in lieu of a traditional audit. Covet your views on that. That's actually a proposal that we made. We made that as part of our regulatory reform agenda, and said that the desktop audit was a simple way to give a safety rating to all 536,000 motor carriers and in the mischief of SMS, with the idea that it would be a screening tool and that everyone, new carrier and over a couple of years, everybody would get a satisfactory safety rating if they passed this preliminary audit. The way that it came out is entirely different. It's basically allowing the agency to bypass all of the traditional protections of an on-site audit and still use SMS to select carriers. The virtue of what we were intending to do would give every small guy who got in business the effect of not being unrated, but having a satisfactory safety rating based upon a desktop audit. So, I think you see that no good deed goes unpunished. And what we were trying to do was level the playing field for small carriers who passed a fairly benign desktop audit. It looks like, and I guess our fear now is that they're still going to use SMS to validate their assumption and go looking for to prove themselves right with desktop audits. So I covet your view of that. I didn't know whether or not you were aware that it was originally our idea that a desktop audit's a whole lot better than SMS.
Chuck, I didn't know where – I mean, Hank, I didn't know where it came from, but clearly they can audit more people. And it is a better use of the officer's time, except for the motor carriers that have a real tragic thing they need to look in deep. Second is, I agree with you that we need some rating based on what we know about them, which would be a combination of the roadside inspections plus the desktop audit to get this. Right this minute, Chuck, the last time I did, and I'm talking about people with MC numbers, 86% of motor carriers with MC numbers are unrated. only 11% are satisfactory, 3.5% are conditional, and less than 0.1% is unsatisfactory, because if they're unsatisfactory and they're for hire, they're not going to get a load. So we've got all right. these people out there that have had no rating. Now, some of those have had an inspection and a focus inspection at their location, actually have been fined for things, violations, but it did not end up with a rating because it's the mechanics that Hank's talking about the inspection process. But that is the concern.
And the
I have.
issue is that the federal government told that agency to issue a safety rating to all 536,000, and they never came up with a way to do that, leaving in limbo new small carriers as unrated as fodder for plaintiff's bar, as subject to higher insurance rates, and as identified as potential bad actors. So what we were trying to do is say, look, if you're going to give this guy a preliminary audit and a brush through, unless you select him for a full-blown audit, give him a SAT. And make that applicable to everybody. Every small carrier who gets in business is going to get a desktop audit, should be willing to pay $450 to have that audit give him a satisfactory safety rating so he can compete with the big boys. And, you know,
totally
that's true regulatory reform, but that's not what we got.
Well, you know what? You're right on the money there, Hank.
Let me correct what Hank said. Every insurance company that I'm aware of, because you typically call them smaller motor carriers, do not look unfavorable and unrated.
Right.
I wrote many blogs about that. We're over that hurdle, Hank. That's not from an insurance standpoint. An unrated motor carrier is not considered unfavorable from insurance.
If that were the case, Tommy, Progressive wouldn't be the only damn dude that writes half these little guys. You know as well as I do that plaintiff's bar's first argument is, Mr. Shipper, you used an unrated carrier. He hadn't been examined by the FMCSA. He hasn't been found safe to operate. You should have done something else. And the reason for that is, and you know, when it first came out, all the major shippers said you had to have a satisfactory safety rating and barred a lot of little guys. Even now, they're so damn scared of an unrated thing. It's a pearl of great price if you're in that 11% and have a SAT, even though it was issued 15 years ago. So all I'm saying is, I think there is an insurance component of it. And I think anybody who is a newbie and doesn't have a satisfactory safety rating is going to say that he's paying a premium because he doesn't have a SAT.
He may not be paying a premium, but he's not getting some of the freight that the satisfactory carriers are able to get. What do you think of that?
Chuck, I agree with that, but I haven't seen the insurance industry, particularly the smaller ones, penalizing something. Hank, I disagree with you on that part of it. I understand the economics of it, and understand you're talking from a shipper being liable for doing the due diligence. That's a little different than the motor carrier, because the insurance company for the motor carrier is unrated itself. And that is a concern that Chuck just brought up, is the shipper being held extraordinarily liable for choosing an unrated carrier to give the load to from a due diligence standpoint. I can understand the shipper's anxiety over that.
Well, all I can say, Tommy, is, and I can cite client after client that's got less than 10 trucks and tell you that they can command one rate if they've got a SAT, and yep. otherwise they might as well go fishing to try to find the insurance.
Chuck,
the SAT is a pearl of great price.
I'd love for you to send me that, but I'm unaware of that. But let me tell you what my fear is in this, okay? Because we're going to end up in the same place. My fear in this is that because of what Hank just talked about, it is that all the material that's being required, log books, maintenance books, audit the logs, all that insurance, the whole thing that's required at a on-site for compliance review is going to be required on this desktop, this remote review, and the motor carrier is going to have to send that up electronically in 24 hours, 48 hours. And my concern is, again, going back, I agree with Hank in this, they're going to look at more smaller motor carriers because they are going to attempt to populate the ratings, to get more people with ratings. And they're going to look at the motor carrier, the smaller motor carriers, where before they did not give a full compliance review and you did not get a – they've done desktop ratings to start with, but they're going to – but they, this does not lead to a compliance review. It left the fines and things like that, and that end up with a rating. And what I'm worried about is some of these smaller motor carriers are totally unprepared to send those documents up in a form that that inspection, the officer is going to be able to discern, to look at without digging deep. And my concern, Hank, is that now they're going to walk out with a conditional rating, and now they're going to be put out of business. That's my concern.
I agree with
you. What I'm
let the listener hear that I say amen to that, because the new carrier audit is now primarily conducted by state people who are here to work with the small motor carrier to get them in compliance. They're not sent in with the idea that you need to get a scalp under your belt because this guy has been identified as a bad actor. So a new carrier audit is really a teaching tool. It is not we're here to get you. And I'm afraid that when it is used in lieu of a full-tail audit and you're profiled as a bad actor before they come in, that the small guy will be at a real disadvantage, particularly given the agency's tendency to try to run things by the number. A small carrier, particularly with respect to accident exposure, currently, if you've got a couple of accidents, they'll look at it and cut you a break. If you've got two accidents and five trucks, you're eight times the national average. If you run that straight by the numbers and you had a bad hair day, it's like going to the gambling casino and putting your life's savings on red number nine. So I'm just saying that the way in which it is utilized really makes all the difference. When we made the idea that they would conduct audits of all 600,000 carriers on an equal standard of we're here to help you and we're going to use this as a tool to identify bad actors, that was one thing. Now to say that we're going to use telemetrics to make this a quick and dirty job of putting you out of business, it becomes yet another. And I agree with Tommy that it is concerning, particularly based upon whether or not the auditor is there to confirm his suspicion that you're a bad actor and starts asking for minutia electronically presented within 24 hours.
Let me give you some statistics. This is through August. There were 3,582 desktop audits through July 31st. In 2019, there were 1,374, 2018, there were 330, 2017, there were 76, and 2016, there were 118. There are going to be more desktop audits this year than all years combined.
Mm-hmm. And are they charging for them the way Hank said? Do you know?
No.
No, what we proposed was that
was a charge.
The desktop audit be biannual, and that when you update your MCS 150, you pay a fee of $400, which basically gives the agency an opportunity to renew your SAP. So we had a proposal that would have allowed the agency to confess that FMCSA should no longer use SMS as a rating tool, and give everybody an equal access to a safety rating every 2 years, which would solve a lot of the problems that small people have in terms of competing.
Right.
Now, you know, the agency has consistently said the desktop audit works and identifies bad actors. We just didn't want it substituted for a regular audit to the prejudice of small carriers.
And let me say one other thing on this part of it. You take the personality off of it. I totally agree with Hank that most of the officers want them to be a safe road, but they come with some compassion and all that. And you develop a rapport. If there's one or two things that they aren't doing right, most a lot of times, depending on the nature of what they're doing wrong and how that's going to be later severe, they got a little comradeship involved in it, and they're usually not there to penalize them. I'm not sure now with the impersonal by phone audit done by, as Hank just said, a bureaucrat or something like that, that personal relationship won't be there anymore. And that could be a concern.
Yeah, and there's
but
a
you know
stigma.
What? The personal relationship.
There's a stigma that a new guy
do.
In a small carrier is a bad actor. That he has to run on fuel. That he doesn't have the safety measurement system in place. That the big guys are too big to fail. What they don't recognize is the small guy either drives the truck or has his brother-in-law drive it and is probably more concerned about the safety of the driver and the safety of the operation than the mega fleets. Yet one accident for a small guy can say you're branded. And it's a numbers game. And all that we've been trying to do is to make the point in this and now the beyond compliance issue that don't forget, guys, that 96% of the people you regulate have less than 10 trucks, and they're the heartbeat of America. There's never, 100%. To my knowledge, been a motor carrier operating more than 500 trucks that's been put out of business in a safety audit.
Now, let me add one thing, because I don't want to get – Hank and I are talking about a lot of issues that are very important to discuss. And not who's listening to us. Who's listening to us are truckers that are truck every day. So what I hope they hear out of this, and what Hank's saying has a lot of merit and all that, that they're going to be more susceptible to a desktop audit that might end up with a compliance review. So they've got to look to somebody, their insurance agency, outside loss prevention people, their retail agent, to help them get in compliance. To help them have all the paperwork in place so that when they get that letter and say produce these records, they can then send that to the FMCSA and in a form that FMCSA wants it to receive and explain things. From checking the audits and this stuff, from the drug test, have they a clearinghouse, have they registered the drivers, all that stuff, even Chuck that you pointed out about onboarding a driver, they've got to be able to send that. And what we're trying to talk, and I've done a webinar on it. I'm going to do another webinar on it next month, and one of the sessions at the annual conference is going to encourage retail agents to be proactive to help the motor carrier be prepared for these audits, because I see it's happening. So that's what I want to hear. What Hank and I talk about, we can talk about all the time, but it doesn't affect that driver behind the wheel today. I don't, you know, fair or unfair, it's what's going to happen. So they got to be prepared to have all their paperwork in place.
Tommy is just giving me the opportunity to make a plug. And that is, 4 years ago when we saw this coming, we designed a program called TransComply for new carriers. And unlike some of the really expensive programs that a small carrier can't comply, we gave small carriers at a nominal fee the checklist of things that was going to be asked on the new carrier audit and a manual of the kinds of things you could be asked. And there's a real need for that. We've worked with NASDIC and other groups to comply with it. I think that as a cottage industry, somebody who cares about small carriers and can tell you, look, here's what If you get a desktop audit and it follows the new carrier audit, these are the things they're going to ask for. These are the kinds of things you need to be able to prepare to do in 24 hours, and you can't wait until they send it in to go prepare. You know, it's kind of like you need an instruction manual. If you're new or small carrier, there's a thing that my son told me called the 7 P's. Prior proper planning prevents piss poor performance. And in this issue, if they're going to use this new carrier audit, every small carrier needs to get out ahead of the curve, because sooner or later you're going to get the phone call and they're going to say you got 48 hours to present this. And it's kind of, if you do this, you see that once they come and visit you, now you got 30 days to convince them they're wrong or you're out of business. You got to get ahead of the curve.
And you know what? The best way to get ahead of the curve is to always keep everything up, like 100% up to date. Cross your T's, dot your I's. When they tell you to send the stuff in 24 hours, I would think that if you sent it in right away, they would go, whoa, this guy means business. He's got his stuff together. And I don't think you would get hard with as hard a brush as you would if you waited till 23 hours. I think if they
when you get their letter, it's not the time to call him back and say, what the hell are you talking about?
Exactly. Exactly.
So what I'm trying to do, and Hank and I are basically talking about the same thing, is I'm alerting our agents and saying, look, guys, this is happening. If you want to add the added service to your motor carriers, if you want to help them stay in business, you've got to help them be prepared for this, or there's going to be bad consequences. So that's the bottom line. And that's what I want to share with your audience, Rocco and Chuck, is that this is coming. It's happening. It's happening now. There's going to be far more audits now. They're looking at doing about 7,000 audits this year, and a lot of smaller motor carriers are going to get touched, where before less than 2.5% of all motor carriers got a compliance review. That's changing. And so they're going to get that letter before it's over with, and their whole business life is going to depend on that letter, because if they get a conditional rating, they're not going to get loads and they're not going to get insurance.
Yeah, and you see, we made the value decision that getting every new entrant a safety rating in over 2 years, getting any small carrier who was fit to operate a SAT, affected your access to freight and your access to insurance, and that the new carrier audit was something that a responsible small carrier could comply with. And, you know, hopefully they haven't turned a blessing into a curse. But, you know, it's a better way to monitor small carrier safety and assure that you're in compliance with safety regulations than to take roadside inspections with all of the vicissitudes of what scale you crossed. So we thought it was a better idea. And it's still a better idea. But at this point, small people just need to say, I'm going to figure out what is on this damn test, and I'm going to maintain the records these people need. Drug testing is one. NASTIC provides a great drug testing program. You got to get part of something like that.
Right.
You got to know at least
that
what
trying.
The tick points are.
That's the point to make, and Hank and I are talking about this. You can't fight it. It's reality, and your whole livelihood depends on it. So if you don't, even if you don't like it, you got to do it. And so be prepared for it. That's what the message that I want to leave.
You know, it's
so how do people get involved with the TransComply, Hank? I know you talked about it for a second, but their website or something. If people are listening in,
they
want to get ahead
of
this thing.
Yeah, you can go to my website and get it. Yeah, what happened is we put together the manuals and the other things that were necessary together with Rick Gobble. I think, Rico, you know Rick. He's actually a consultant at FMCSA and was a state director for years. So he understands the new carrier audit, And he's the one that made the presentation to the FMCSA and the DOT supporting what is done. So what we're doing is for a nominal fee, particularly to new carrier audits or anyone else, saying, look, here's not just the manual, here's the tick list of what's on the new carrier audit. Here's the kinds of things you need to prepare for. And if people are interested on it, they can contact me at the website and we can make it available. I think, you know, if somebody's on your door, Rick can help you out. But the real advantage is get ahead of the curve, and I think that's like $150, and you've got kind of a hand-to manual of how to get through the new carrier audit. And, you know, to the extent that they modify it to request the kind of data they would ask in person, you know, Rick's available as a consultant to modify what you've got and lead you through it. I mean, a lot of people know there's J.J. Keller available to large carriers with big risk departments. That kind of price point is not something a small guy can absorb. We're trying to do it in a simpler and easier way to do it. But it's similar to the kind of manuals that J.J. Keller provides.
Let me add one other thing. Let everybody hear it. If you're listening, ask your retail agent about this, and do they know about it? If they don't know about it, go find a retail agent who does, because there are some out there who listen to me and Chuck and Hank and the things that we produce that will be able to help them walk through this. And that would be what I would hope they would do, that learn to at least ask them, how can you help me with these desktop audits, or even do you know about them? If they don't know about them, they're not staying abreast of what's happening to you on the highway.
Yeah, let me put in a plug here. Before we run out of time, let me put in a plug, lest you think that Tommy and I are combatants. I think that if you've got a retail agent, you should ask him if he participates in the motor carrier program that Tommy has. And if he says, what's that? He's just like a motor carrier who tells an auditor, what are logs? The people that are there to serve you, need to understand the industry better than you do and need to help you with it. Now, I can tell you, and Tommy will say amen to this, I think, there are a whole lot of underwriters who don't do their due diligence to help you out. They just write based upon the numbers, and getting an intelligent retail agent is the first line of defense, because unfortunately a lot of small carriers have to rely on the man that sells them insurance to help along with safety. I could use more time than we've got to talk about some big insurance brokers that I'm dealing with who don't understand what they're selling. In this age when shippers are asking for the moon and expecting coverage, the retail brokers with the big names don't even know what the policy contains. So obviously getting some guy who knows truck insurance and is not just a good guy hanging out at the golf course is ultimately very important to your livelihood.
You couldn't have said it better, Hank. I've been a real proponent of dealing with real truck insurance providers for the last 40-odd years, and the relationship I have with our agent is it's sacred. I get calls all the time, other agents trying to hone in on that business, and there's never been any reason to change. And I just want to warn any of our listeners out there, number one, I did speak to one of our listeners recently that's dealing directly with an insurance company, and I shudder when I think of that. It's just not a good policy. You want to deal with a insurance agent that understands trucking. You need them in your corner, especially in this market with all this, pardon my language, crap going on. You really need an insurance agent that understands your business. And make sure
with
you have one.
With this caveat, I will agree with you. If your insurance agent says that there is this thing called an Accord. That's what he's getting for you. And it says that you have insurance. Don't believe it. Number two, if the guy needs to earn his keep, he's your agent and he owes you due diligence. Put in writing the insurance that you require and have him put in writing that the cheap-ass policy he's sending you provides that coverage. Because you don't want to get in a... Yeah, I'm talking about the underwriting
cargo
process. Yeah,
no,
but not only cargo, but also
no, no, no. I'm not saying, but mainly cargo is where there's more variety and more chances they're not going to get the coverage that's promised in that area. There are other things, but you got to deal with it, Hank.
Yeah.
And that stuff. By the way, Hank mentioned what the certificate insurance the shippers are asking for. I do have a white paper on our website that addresses meeting those requirements and explaining what they're asking for and how to get it. And that would be something that I wrote for retail agents. And I wrote it in conjunction with our friends in South Carolina. Hank, I'm sure you don't mind me saying Rob's name on that part of it to help me write it.
What's that website?
Yeah,
not at all.
Not at all. My interest is in seeing that if you think that the cheapest insurance is the best insurance, you missed it. You need to be very careful in telling whoever is bidding on your insurance what you need and tell them that you expect them to disclose to you any liability, any restriction or caveat in that 100-page document that keeps you from getting exactly what you want.
Right, Rocco, let me pull it down a little bit here. Our website is MCIEF. Motor Carriers Insurance Education Foundation.org. We only have information. We're not there to sell you. We don't charge you for anything. We're just there to help you walk through your problem. We won't solicit you. If you want us to help you find an agent, we'll give you references, some that might address you, your thing. Or if you have a question, you can go to that website. It's the motor carrier side, and you ask me a question, or there's phone numbers there, and you're more than willing to call me. We have white papers that are available. Download, like the one that Hank just mentioned about certificate insurances. We've got Tom Bray with Dre J. Keller did a webinar on electronic log. The one we're going to do next a week from the second Thursday of next month at 2:00 when we deal with the thing we talked about, the off-site audits. So please be free to do that. And ask your agent if they're do they have a TRS designation. If they don't, you might want them to go to this website so they can learn more about your business. So that's what I'd like to end up with saying, Rocco, as we're getting close to the hour.
I want to say I was at Tommy's his annual convention last September down in Orlando, and there were 600 agents there, and these people knew their stuff. It was a pleasure talking to them. These were real truck insurance agents, and I hope to gosh that our listeners in the United States can go to insurance agents that are members of Tom's Foundation. I'm not here to pump up Tom's Foundation. I think they do a great job, but it's just these people were in the know. They knew about trucking, and they were there to further their education on their trucking insurance customers, which means a lot to me as somebody that buys truck insurance.
Tommy, one more time, give them that web, the web address one more time real quick.
MCIEF, Motor Carrier Insurance, then the last two, Education Foundation, .org.
All right, I'm going to try to link that to the Rates and Lanes Facebook page. I'm going to try to get that, make sure I link that. Want to thank you fine gentlemen for taking time out of your busy schedule to come on and join us on the Rates and Lanes podcast. The hour just blew by, which I knew it was. So once again, from the bottom of my heart, I want to, just like I say, just thank you guys. Hopefully the listeners, I definitely was an entertaining but very informative hour that we've had here tonight. So tell a friend to tell a friend about the podcast. This is some of the things that this is the whole purpose of doing this podcast is to get information out there, actionable information that you can put into your toolbox and stay ahead of the curve so that best operated areas in the country. That's the whole purpose of us doing this podcast. So with that being said, I want to thank you for taking time out of your schedule, the listeners, for taking time out of your schedule to be here with us. You could have been anywhere else in the world, but you chose to take a little time out and hang out with us, and we definitely appreciate it. Until the next time, we want to say God bless you, good night, and we'll keep it in between the mustard and the mayonnaise, and we'll talk to you next week. Chuck?
Yeah, it's on the flip-flop. God bless.
Enjoyed it, guys. Good night.
Thanks, Hank. Chuck, Rocco. See y'all later.